looking at a passage from Acts chapter 3 today, and we're talking about a lame man who is lying at the temple gate as Peter and John go into the temple for prayer. And so kind of to set this up a little bit, I want to talk a little bit about this lame guy and kind of what that entails. Now, you have to understand that in the New Testament period, there was generally an assumption that if somebody had some sort of malady like this, that a person was born lame, that there was a sin that was connected to that. And so you were seen, fairly or not, as a sinful person, or your family was sinful if you had a condition like this. So it's important kind of to note that not only were you physically outcast from society, but that a lot of times people in this condition would be spiritually outcast as well. All right, so just I think that's kind of important information as we get into the text this morning. So we're going to pick up in Acts chapter 3, verse 1. It says, Peter and John were going to the temple at the ninth hour of prayer, and a man who had been lame from his mother's womb was being carried along, whom they used to set down every day at the gate of the temple, which is called Beautiful. So this was the Beautiful Gate, in order to beg alms of those who were entering the temple. And when he saw Peter and John about to go into the temple, he began asking to receive alms. All right, so I kind of want to kind of start this morning with this understanding of logistics. Now, this man, obviously, because he's lame, he can't work, and so he relies on having money for food and for clothing and other needs. He relies on the gifts of individuals. And so because he is relying on that, he wants to be in a high traffic area. Now, you may have noticed that on a lot of intersections around Greenville, the busy intersections, you'll a lot of times see people standing out at those intersections with cardboard signs, whatnot, asking for help. There's a reason people go to those intersections, because they're high traffic areas. And you don't have to have a high percentage of people to give you something. If there's a lot of traffic moving through an area, even a low percentage will bring about some benefit. So this man would frequent the Beautiful Gate, which was the main entrance into the temple area. So you can imagine in a city the size of Jerusalem how much traffic moves in and out of this gate. Which means probably most everybody in Jerusalem knew who this guy was. They had seen him there. This was his spot, and he would be there trying to receive alms. Now, the question becomes this. Why does this man want to be in such a public place? Now, when I originally wrote this sermon, which feels like a month ago, When I originally wrote the first draft of this, I was going to do this sermon through the eyes of Peter and John. This sermon was all going to be about Peter and John. But it's not going to be about Peter and John this morning. It's going to be about the beggar. It's going to be about this guy. Now, I want you to think about the culture that we live in today. Okay? Think about the culture that we live in. Now, for some of you who are old like me, or older than me, This feels very weird, right? Facebook, I'm told by my children, is for old people. They tell me that old people get on Facebook. Now, I remember, I don't even know what they would say about MySpace. That's like for super old people, I guess. But we live in a world now. I mean, you think about this. Think about how much stuff is consumed on social media, in platforms like Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat. I'll probably miss TikTok, which is incredibly irritating, and YouTube. Okay? Now, what do all of those things have in common? And I'll tell you, just so I don't get a lot of weird answers. Here's what all those things have in common. They are mechanisms by which people can be seen. We live in a world today where people have a need to be seen. And a lot of times we look at that and go, oh, well, that's just it's arrogance or it's desire to be famous. But I think it goes deeper than that, right? We all have some desire to think that people see us. Now, sometimes people go out of their way to be unseen. Some of you are that kind of person. Some of you are introverted enough in the classical sense of the term introvert, that you would just as soon go into a place and stay anonymous and walk out and not have anybody speak to you. You're perfectly content for nobody to know who you are. But generally speaking, even people like that want to be seen. Maybe they don't want to be bothered, but they want to be seen. Twitter is a place where people can go to be heard. I want to share my opinion. However intelligent or stupid it is, I want people to know what I think. And I'm going to put pictures out there. You remember the good old days when people used to take pictures of their food and put it on Facebook? I miss those days. Man, I used to think that was the stupidest thing in the world, and now I long for when people just took pictures of their food. But there is a need in this culture to be seen, and it's not new. It's not new. And one of the things that's amazing about social media is not just that we want to be seen, but it gives us the ability to control the narrative. Because not only do we want to be seen, but we want people to see what we want them to see. I hope this is okay. I didn't get approval. Wayne, can I talk about you for a minute? Boy, you talk about putting somebody on the spot. Wayne's like, no, I don't want you talking. Wayne did the community meditation last week, and it was the first time he'd done one here. And so I sent him a little message. I was like, Wayne, you did a great job. He goes, it was awful. I said, Wayne, it was great. It was fantastic. And I'm just going to tell you, and if Wayne gets mad at me afterwards, I'll have to apologize to him. But Wayne said, I don't know, I didn't like it. I got emotional. And I was like, that's what made it great. That's what made it great. But I get exactly what Wayne's saying there. So, sometimes we don't want people to see that side of us, right? We feel like it doesn't look professional or to, you know, and I'm one of those people, I don't like to be emotional in public. I kind of like to be very, this is me, and I kind of control what I put out there. And I've shared with some of you before that when Caleb was in the hospital, I was very deliberate about how I handled my business at church, because I really did not want people in the church to see the minister struggling. And because I had it in my head that people did not need to see me struggling. And I was struggling. I was struggling a lot, but I didn't want people to see that, because I thought, well, it's not good for people to see the minister struggling with faith, because that's not a good thing. And so I didn't want people to see that, right? I wanted to control what people saw. And so as a culture, this is how we are. We now have all these platforms where we can go out and we want to be seen, but we don't really want to be seen. We want people to see what they see. And we want to control what that is. So here's this man who's an outcast in his own society. And what does he want more than anything else? He wants to be seen. He doesn't want to be seen as a sinner. He doesn't want to be seen as a paralytic. He just wants to be seen as what? As a person. He's right. He's a person. How many of you have ever been defined by some trait that you have, and you're like, I hate that people define me that way? Right? I wish people could just see me like a normal person, but people, we by the way, we tend to judge people by their worst moments. We tend to judge people by their sin, by their failings, by their disabilities, by their color, by their background. by their income. We have all these things. And a lot of times we all feel that same thing. So I wish people would just see me for me. I wish people would see beyond the stuff and just see me. And so here's this man who's been a paralytic since birth, no control over it, had nothing to do with it. He didn't do anything wrong. But he is suffering. He is suffering the consequences of this condition. And he just wants people to see him. And so he's out there in public. And yes, it gives him access so people can give him alms. But, you know, he is in a high traffic place so people see him. All right? So let's see what happens when the right people see him. Verse 4, it says, "But Peter, along with John, fixed his gaze on him." Now, let me ask you a question. When you hear that term, "fixed his gaze on him," what do you picture? They stared at him. They looked intently at him. In other words, what did they do? They saw him. They saw him. They didn't see the disability. They didn't see the sin. They saw him, and they fixed their gaze. How many of you have ever had somebody talk to you, but they didn't look at you when they were talking to you? When people don't look at you when they're talking to you, what do you normally assume? I've been married for 26 years, and I still have not learned this trick. That when my wife is in her chair, and I'm in my chair, and she's talking to me, I will look at the TV and talk to her. Some of you who have been married a long time know how this story ends. If you knew how many times she's been talking to me and I was looking at the TV and then I hear this because I'm listening, I hear this: "You're not listening." Now my wife is in the back going, "I don't say it like that. I just can tell you how I hear it." But I understand it, right? And we've been married 26 years. So you would think by now, what would I learn to do? Look at her when she's talking to me. Because if I don't, I miss all the glorious facial expressions that come with what she's telling me. But sometimes we don't pay attention, right? We don't pay attention. And we do that sometimes where we talk to each other and we really talk at each other more than to each other. You ever ask anybody how they were doing and you didn't listen to see what they said in response? You ever ask somebody how they were doing hoping that they would just say, "I'm fine," so you didn't have to engage them in a conversation? Because then if they say, "I'm not doing that well." Oh, rats. Now I got to stand here and listen to you complain. I wish I had just not, you know, we're like that. But Peter says, it says, Peter along with John, they fixed their gaze on this guy. They looked at him intently. And listen to what they said. "Look at us." Now I've read this story 1,000 times. I've preached this story probably 50 times in my life. I've never paid much attention to that. Because usually in the story, we get fixated on the miracle and we get fixated on what happens after the miracle. But there's some power in this verse 4. Peter and John fixed their gaze on him, and their statement to him was what? "Look at us. Look at us. See who we are. See what we have to say." This guy was asking for money, right? It says he began to give them his attention because he was expecting what? To get something from them. We have this emotional need to be seen, but we don't always see other people, right? We can become so fixated on what people see in us that we don't actually look back at the people we want to see us. And I would guess everybody in this room has had some moment in their life where they found out something about somebody that was close to them and they're like, I didn't know. How did I not know that? You ever had that happen? I would guess there's probably some people in this room over the years who have had someone they knew who committed suicide. And they said, after the fact, I never knew. I never knew. We have all experienced people in our lives who were suffering and we were totally oblivious to it. We didn't know they were suffering. And our statement, well, they did a really good job of hiding it. But really, sometimes I think we really have to ask ourselves, was I really paying attention? Did I see that person? And by the way, seeing people takes time, right? It takes investment. Think about this now. Peter and John are walking along, right? They're walking along. And by the way, who thinks that these two guys in the first weeks of the church after Pentecost are busy? You think these guys are busy? You think they got a lot of stuff to do? So they're walking along, and this guy's standing, you know, he's laying there. Well, that was almost the worst faux pas in sermon history. Guy's just standing there on bad legs. This guy's laying there, and they come by, and he, you know, you can imagine, he's like, oh, alms for the poor, you know, he's asking for. Now, what could they have done? By the way, if you can do miracles, you think you can make a couple of coins appear in your pocket? I mean, Peter raised people from the dead, so you think he could conjure up a couple of coins? By the way, if you're thinking, no, Jesus made one appear in a fish's mouth once. So yeah, I'm thinking Peter probably could have found some change if he'd wanted to. They just could have been, man, we're really busy. Just throw that guy some change. Here's some change. Here you go. Have a nice day. And walked on with their business. If some of you are thinking, Stuart, that's really harsh. They could have done better than that. How long would it have taken Peter or John to heal this guy? Like that? Walk by. Hey, you're healed. Have a good day. And keep right on walking. But see, here's the thing. As is generally true, there's more to it. Because what this guy really needed, as much as to receive money or as much as to be healed, was to be seen. He needed to be seen. And he needed to see others beyond his own misery. Any of you ever thought you didn't have time for somebody else's drama because you had enough drama of your own? Right? I think most of us have probably been in that ballpark before. It was like, I don't need somebody else's problems. I got enough problems of my own. So here, Peter and John, they're busy. They got a lot of stuff going on. They got all these new converts. They're preaching the gospel all over Jerusalem, and they got all these people being baptized, and they're trying to get stuff organized and set up, and they're busy. But they stop. And they look at this guy. They fix their gaze on him. But then they say, you need to look at us. And let's see what happens in verse 6. Peter said, I do not possess silver and gold. But what I do have, I give to you. In the name of Jesus Christ, the Nazarene, walk. And seizing him by the right hand, he raised him up, and immediately his feet and his ankles were strengthened. Now, I want to ask you a question. Why didn't this guy ask for healing? Why did he ask him for money? What? Well, does he know who these guys are? Is it plausible? He hasn't even have a clue they can heal him, right? They don't. He may not know who they are, but here's really the fascinating thing about this story. At least that's what I wrote down this morning at 6:45. We live in a world that is obsessed with treating symptoms instead of treating problems. That's our culture. We think the solution to every problem is to treat the symptom. Now, I do not want to get political. If you feel like you need to get political after I say this, doors are there and there. You know, we've done this before. I don't want to hear it. I don't want you to leave here and say, "Ooh, Stuart got political this morning." No, so I'm just giving an example. We think that making guns illegal is going to stop school shootings. It's not. You know why it's not? Because there's already a law against shooting people in school. So another law is not going to fix the problem. And here's why we think that'll fix the problem. Because that's the easy solution, right? If we just pass another law, that'll fix the problem. But that's not going to fix the problem. Because the problem isn't that there are guns. The problem is that there are people who have become so evil in such a psychotic world that they want to take a weapon into a school and shoot innocent children. That's the problem. And we don't want to try to figure out the answer to the problem. We would much rather just treat the symptom because, by the way, treating symptoms is easier, right? How many of you have ever had a medical problem and you thought, "I'm just going to keep treating the symptom because I don't want to go to the doctor"? So you just keep popping ibuprofen, man. I'm just going to keep throwing this ibuprofen down until my liver disintegrates. I'm just going to keep taking the ibuprofen. You know, I know my knee sideways, but I'm not going to the doctor. And I freely confess, I'm one of those people. If I could treat the symptom, I don't even want to see a doctor. Let's treat the symptom. But here's the problem. Treating the symptom doesn't do what? It doesn't fix the problem. Now, let me ask you a question. Why does this guy need money? Because he can't work, right? So money, his inability to work isn't the problem, right? It's a symptom of the problem. The problem is that he's lame. So why is he asking for money? Because that's easier, right? Because I can't expect him to heal me, so I'll just ask for money. That's how he was wired, to ask for money. What? Now, some of you are going, "Stuart, where are you going with this?" Here's where I'm going with this. And when I say we, I mean the people in this room today and the people watching online. We are just like this guy. We're just like this guy. You know why we're like this guy? Because we think that forgiving sin fixes the problem, but it doesn't. It treats the symptom. What is sin a symptom of? Now take a minute and think that one through. Sin is a symptom of brokenness. We're broken and we commit sin. Why do you think Paul had to say, "Should you continue to sin so that grace will increase"? What did he say to that? No, absolutely not. But here's the thing. We believe that if we can just come to church and have some sort of passing relationship with Jesus, we'll get forgiveness of sins and eternal life, and that'll fix the problem. But here's the thing. It doesn't always fix the problem. The problem is that we sin. And so what should the goal of everybody in this room be? To sin no more. Now, I would have gone with less, because that's more likely. We're not going to be perfect in this world, but right? The goal of every one of us should be to sin less next week than we sinned this week, right? Shouldn't that be our goal? But we don't think that way because, well, I have forgiveness of sin, so I don't really have to cut back. You know why I look like this? There's a lot of reasons. But here's the real reason. Because when I was young and I had a metabolism of a billion, I could eat anything I wanted to and as much of it as I wanted to. And I did. And that worked great until what happened? Until that metabolism went boom and ground to a halt. And now, instead of being able to eat two pizzas, I can't drive by a pizza place and smell it. without gaining weight. And so I tell the kids, I'm like, hey, look, let me give you a little advice here. Learn good eating habits when you don't need them. That way you'll have them when you do. We have developed this mindset in the church that we don't really have to see Christ and he doesn't really have to see us. We just let him see what we want to see. And we see the parts we want to see. And we're good with that because it treats the symptom and we feel good. We feel good about that. So the idea that I'm a Christian but I'm still a grumpy, cantankerous, mean person doesn't bother us at all, right? Doesn't bother us at all. We just go, well, that's just how I am. The idea that we're a Christian and we're still hateful or we still gossip or we're still mean to people, that doesn't bother us at all because, like, well, that sin's forgiven. But what's supposed to happen when we become a Christian? What did Paul say is supposed to happen? We're supposed to become what? A new creation. And guess what happens when we become a new creation? That old person, what's supposed to happen to him? It's supposed to go away. It's supposed to go away. But we have bought in to the lie that if we just treat the symptoms, we're fine. We're going to be fine. We'll just treat the symptoms. I got forgiveness of sin, and so the sin's not a problem. I don't have to worry about why I sin or where the sin comes from because the sin's covered because it's like ibuprofen. If I just take enough of it, I don't feel the pain. And so if I just take communion once a week and I come to church every once in a while and I say a few prayers and I ask for forgiveness, then the origin of my sin isn't an issue. Doesn't matter because it's forgiven. Now, your sins are forgiven. I don't want to give anybody the impression they're not. But I think we missed the point. We missed the point on this. It says, Peter says, look, I don't possess silver and gold. But what I have, I'm going to give to you. Now, let me ask you a question. Who in here thinks it would have been easier for Peter and John to just toss this guy some money? I mean, that'd been easier, right? It'd been a lot easier. So here's the question. Why didn't they do that? That's not what he needed. And see, we have an entire community of people who need something, and a lot of them don't even know what they need. They don't even know. They're like this guy. He thought he knew what he needed. He thought what he needed was money. But if there's one thing I can tell you from paying taxes, it's that giving the government more money never solves their problems. Right? Huh? Or ours. By the way, any of you ever remember thinking that if you made a little bit more money, all your financial problems would be gone? And then you got a raise and you're like, yeah, it didn't go away. You know why? Because now I spend more. I just spend more. Then there's always bills. There's always bills to pay. There's always stuff going on. This guy didn't even know what to ask for. And I would dare say that everybody in this room knows somebody who's not a Christian, who knows they need something, but they don't know what they need. They can't even identify it. They don't know what they need. And the irony is, you do. You know what they need. But here's the problem. To give them what they need, you have to invest time. You have to invest time. Peter and John are busy, but they stop and they look this guy in the eye and they tell him, you look at me. We're going to look at you. You look at me. We're going to communicate with you what you need. Now, I want you to notice what happens in the next verse. This is really important. We're going to go to verse 8 now. Listen to the reaction here. So the guy, Peter reaches down, grabs the guy, pulls him up. Says, with a leap, he stood upright and began to walk. All right, now let's stop there. We talked about this because we talked about a different healing of a lame person in our morning coffee with Christ this morning. There's a miracle within the miracle, right? This guy, how long has he been lame? His whole life, since birth. Peter and John heal his legs. What does he immediately do? He stands up and walks. Now, when I was 12, I broke my femur playing football. For those of you who are not medically inclined, that would be this bone, the thigh bone, right there. I broke it at an angle, so they put me in traction. So I spent 4 weeks in traction with a steel rod drilled through my leg and a little pulley system with weights and all this stuff. So I spent 4 weeks in a hospital bed in traction, and then when the bone began to knit, they took the steel thing out of my leg and put me in a body cast where I stayed for 9 weeks. If you're doing the math, that's 13 weeks. When I got out of the body cast, I thought, I'm good now. So I remember I was laying there on the bed, and I said, the doctor said, okay, can you sit up? And I went, of course. And I was like, I'm going to need a little help. So they pulled me up, and they pulled me up, and I was sitting up, and they turned me loose, and I went, poof. I couldn't even sit up. They said, you're going to need rehab. I said, what do you mean rehab? They said, you got to learn to walk again. I said, I've been walking my whole life. They said, okay, cowboy, show us. You know how long it took me to learn to walk again? Like 5 weeks. I was on a walker. And it's the weirdest thing because you're standing on a walker and you're going, I know how to do this. Been doing it my whole life. I'm not moving. Why am I not moving? And I remember having to actually tell my leg to pick up and move. And if that wasn't bad enough, I remember watching my son when he got out of his coma and they first got him out of bed, and he had to learn to walk again. Okay? This guy's never walked in his life. What happens when Peter heals him? He gets up and he starts walking. Oh, but it's better than that. With a leap, he stood and began to walk, and he entered the temple with them. What's he doing? Walking and leaping and praising God. Cartwheels. I picture cartwheels. You know? Now, why is he so excited? Because for the first time in his life, somebody saw his real need and fixed it. You think he'd have gotten that excited about some coins? No. So, let me ask you a question this morning. If Jesus has really fixed what's wrong with you, why aren't you like this? Why aren't you more excited? If Jesus has really looked at you and you've looked at him and you guys have seen each other and you've really let him fix what's broken and not just some cosmetic stuff. It's like, oh, the sin's still there, but it's forgiven. But no, I've become a new creation. I have become a new person. I'm not that same person I used to be. I'm actually something better now. I'm something different. Why aren't we more like this? I mean, think about this. In what kind of world do you have to beg a person who Jesus Christ has fundamentally changed to come worship him? Does that make any sense to you? Does it make any sense at all that if Jesus Christ has fundamentally changed who you are, he has looked at you, he has seen the need in your life, the need that other people can't see, the part of you that you don't let other people see, the hurt that's been in your life forever, dating back to maybe when you were a kid, to maybe some sin you committed that you've never been able to forgive yourself of, or maybe something that someone else has done to you that has hurt you. And you've let Jesus see that, and he's seen that in you, and you've looked at him. He has told you, look at me. And he has gone inside and changed you. Why aren't we like this? Why are we so And I wonder if it's because we really haven't let Jesus fix us. We've just let him bandage us. We've let him do some cosmetic work. We're letting him dispense ibuprofen. Here's some topical stuff. Was that stuff lidocaine? Is it lidocaine that you can now buy over the counter? Well, that's glorious for a pulled muscle. That's good stuff. Can't even feel it. You know what happens when that wears off? You feel it. You feel it. You take some ibuprofen. I love that commercial where the guy takes ibuprofen. He's jumping in the pool with his kids. And then the next morning he's like, oh, and he can barely move. You know, that's kind of what a lot of us have done with God. We let him give us something to deaden the pain a little, something to make it go away for a while. But really, really at our core, that part of us that's really causing the hurt is still there. Because we've never let Jesus fix it. And so we carry it around with us. It says this guy goes walking and leaping and he's praising God. And all the people saw him walking and praising God. And they were taking note of him as being the one who used to sit at the gate and beg alms. And they were filled with wonder and amazement at what had happened to him. Some of you have friends who know who you really are. They've known you a long time. They've looked at you. They've seen you. Maybe they know stuff about you you just assume them not know. Some of you have those friends. I got a few. And you wonder why they've never seen you like this. It says the people that knew that guy were filled with wonder and amazement at what had happened to him. What were they so amazed by? He was walking. Somebody had finally healed and fixed that thing in him that no amount of money would fix. So I want to close with a question this morning as the praise team comes and prepares to lead us in our communion song. It's a real simple question. And it's not a question for me to judge. This is really for you. This is some self-examination for you. However long you've had a relationship with God, however long you've had a relationship with Jesus, it's a real simple thing. Have you ever really looked at Jesus and let him look at you and address the things in your life that are broken? Or have you tried to hang on to those things and just use Jesus as a pain patch or some ibuprofen? I think sometimes that's how we treat the Lord's Supper. If I just come take communion once a week, it'll make the pain go away for another week. And that's not what the Lord's Supper meant to be. This isn't ibuprofen. This isn't lidocaine. We carry burdens and we carry scars and a lot of us carry real, tangible damage. A lifetime of that stuff. And Jesus wants to help you get relief from that. He wants to heal it. He wants to change who you are. So here's the question. Do you let him? Have you ever really let Jesus see you, see the hurt, see those things? The things that we can't see, because you know, I see mostly what you guys let me see, and so do your friends in the church. We're usually pretty good at hiding stuff from each other. But Jesus sees it all and he wants to fix it. But you have to let him. You have to make that choice. So this morning, I want you to think about that question. Have you ever really let Jesus address the issues in your life, or are you just trying to let him treat the symptoms?